Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we visit about plants that look their best in the summer months. Liz Freemuth back with us. She provides concierge horticultural services all around the country through her business called The Garden Hole. She has some suggestions for annuals, perennials, and shrubs, so I hope you'll join in our conversation. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and believe me, we would love to hear from you. Liz Freemuth, can't see you, but I'm looking forward to hearing your voice.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. The big question for me is, how are you doing during this pandemic time? We haven't talked with you in several months.
Yeah, this has been interesting from a business standpoint. A lot of my clients far away didn't get to see me this year, but you know, we talk, we email, we text, it works out just great. And what I'm finding is absolutely fantastic right now is that while many people are home, they're rediscovering how much they love gardens, which is fantastic.
Well, I think you're certainly right about that. Well, one thing I think gardeners like is to have an interesting garden pretty much all year round. And sometimes the summer gardens can look a bit tired. What should we keep in mind when we're planning for plants that look good at, say, this time of year?
Yeah, you know, let's start with taking a look at a few annuals. A thousand of them that we could use. We sometimes forget that annuals are worth their weight in gold. They really are, because during those kind of blah times where you're not in spring and you're not in fall, they really do give us continuous color and interest and, you know, things like that. So some that I love and I've loved throughout the last, 400 years I've been gardening, one for sure is called Persian Shield or Strobilanthus, and that has got absolutely fantastic purple metallic look to the leaves, and the flower is sort of but the leaves themselves are fantastic. And other than deep shade, it does really well with partial shade, full sun. It needs a little bit more water so the leaves don't dry out, but that gives absolutely fantastic look to containers and even in garden beds. And so that's a nice one. Also, in kind of that outstanding leaf look, we can look at the alocasias or the colocasias, which are the elephant ear plants.
Yeah.
Very tropical. You know, some of those are so huge they could take up, you know, the entire front of somebody's house. But starting those early and getting a good head start, like in February or so inside, will give you some good size. And they're tolerant as well. They, for the most part, like quite a bit of light, but they'll tolerate a little bit of dry. The leaves will get smaller, but if they have a lot of moisture, they'll be big. So, you know, you've got that, and then you've got heliotrope, which to me is one of those oldies but goodies. And they've been doing a lot of breeding on getting the scent back into heliotrope. And so it's a beautiful, you know, they used to call it cherry pie plant because it has sort of a scent of slightly fruity, slightly vanilla, just very, very nice. And there's everything from a deep purple to a white that now has fragrance. So that's good. Another one that I'm really liking in the annual world is Rex begonias. And, you know, those we typically have used as houseplants. And they're a little touchy, but the leaves are outstanding on them. One in particular that has been really, to me, an eye catcher is called Escargot. And the pattern on the leaves looks like a snail. So the leaf actually curls a bit, and then the color pattern follows that curl. And so it looks like a snail. And so it's really quite fun. And you know, we've got the standards, another oldie but goodie is coleus and zinnias. And cosmos. And, you know, one of the unusual cosmos that people can use if they want something a little different is actually called chocolate cosmos. And it has a scent of chocolate on it. Mm. And so that's fun. And Thunbergia, the black-eyed Susan vine, that's awesome. You know, so those are some of the annuals that we can use. You know, some are good for shade, some are good for sun. Just check how they grow. And, you know, if you can't find plants, which is kind of the problem this year, is a lot of people went back to gardening, so we're having difficulties finding some plants. A lot of them can be grown by seeds. Zinnias, cosmos, still, you can put the seed in the ground and have plants. So that's some of the annuals.
Perennials, and when you look what at about them?
Perennials, when you start looking at what's going to give me some impact during the summer, I have to say one of my favorite plants over the last 10 years has been the Japanese forest grass, the Hikani Kloa. And the variegated and the golds are fantastic. They've got some that have a little bit of red tinge on the blades. And those are grasses that grow in shade. And I even have them in some sites in full sun. But I will tell you a proviso. If you have full dry sun, don't put them in. They'll scorch. But especially in areas that have a lot of moisture underground, they love it. They will grow anywhere and everywhere. If it's a little bit dry and you have to provide moisture, then put them in shade. Make sure they get established, and then they'll be fine. I mean, they're just beautiful. And anybody in the Madison area, I think if you've been to the Botanic Garden, you've seen their beautiful displays of the Japanese forest grass. They're lovely. Coming up is one that will flower late summer into fall is Vernonia. And I don't know if you guys have talked about that when you've talked about prairie plants, but that is a fantastic flowering fall, late summer fall plant. And if you get the species, they can actually get up to be, you know, close to 6 feet tall. So not the kind of plant you want in your average yard, but they've done some breeding and brought the height down to about 3 feet. And it's a very upright, has smallish purple flowers on it and beautiful leaf, kind of a feathery leaf. So really quite lovely. Standards for summer for me are Nepeta. That's always a good one. The really good cultivars to use are going to be Joanna Reed, Six Hills Giant, Walker's Low. Those are really good plants to put in. A recommendation for Nepeta when you're growing it is after it flowers, if you want to force the flower to come back, you can cut it back a little bit, and about 6 weeks later, it'll reflower tremendously. Joanna Reed actually will do it on its own without having to cut back much. It will cover the old growth. So that's kind of nice. A new one on the market over the last 5-6 years has been Calamintha, which is related to Nepeta, and it flowers from June until October. And it's got a beautiful white cloud look to it, and the pollinators love it. Absolutely love it. And let's see, Yarrow, always a good one. You know, right now with the yellow, the moonshine and the gold coronation, Yarrow are fabulous. Baptisia is just finishing up, but the seed heads are wonderful on that all throughout the season. And hibiscus are just starting to kind of come into their own, so they're going to be more of a midsummer flower. And you can do the big dinner plate size, the Mashudos, or, you know, we've got the hardy Cereacus that does really well, and Liatris, and Ligularia, and lilies, and, you know, the salvias. And don't forget the salvias, and the sedums, and the clematis, and, you know, so many that we kind of tend to forget about. You know, we focus on spring, we get excited about spring, and then we sort of take a breather and realize, oh, wait a minute, I forgot about summer. So those are some that people can add in. And, you know, if we look at shrubs that are good during the summer, Hypericum, which is St. John's wort, is a beautiful shrub for summer. It's now just the buds are starting to form, and they'll open into beautiful yellow flowers. And one in particular called Blue Velvet has narrow leaves that have a bluish tinge to them. And after the summer flower, we get to enjoy a multicolor fall leaf. So there will be everything from kind of a goldish yellow to a purple to a blue on each leaf. And so just phenomenal. Yeah. And, you know, hydrangeas, there's a hydrangea for every site, just about. So, you know, take a look at your conditions and pick one that's going to work for you. Calacanthus, which I've talked about in the past when we've been together, that one is just now starting to finish flowering, and we'll get a second light flowering throughout the summer here. So that one is nice. I love to have hazelnut, the corallus, in my yard because as the fruit sets, as the nuts set, they're beautiful. They look like flowers. They're just beautiful. Colquitia has just finished blooming, and that one is sometimes called beauty bush. I've got one called Dream Catcher that I like to use. That the flowers are pink, but and they're just finishing, but the leaves are a yellow gold with chartreuse and orange edges on them right now. And it adds a pop of beautiful color to the yard. And that will stay all summer, all the way until fall. So not the flowers themselves, but you're going to get tremendous interest from the leaves. Let's see, Cephalanthus, button bush. Let's see how many more I can look around my yard, tell you what I've got.
I'm already calculating what all this would cost me.
It's never too much, Larry. It's never too much for a garden. Buttonbush is just starting to set their flowers right now. It's a late plant to emerge. It looked dead up until about 2 weeks ago, and then all of a sudden the leaves start popping, and they're a beautiful, shiny green, and the buttons look like little, in fact, there's a cultivar called Sputnik that actually looks like little Sputniks on the end. And when the flowers dry up, they are these hard brown button looking things on the end. And we're really in the southern part starting to edge into where it might be iffy. And so I think in Madison, you might still be able to get away with it, but further north, definitely not. But they do tolerate a lot of moisture. You know, likewise with hibiscus, they will tolerate a lot of root moisture. So if you've got an area that that needs some remediation for water, those actually will do a good job for you. And, you know, and then one of my favorites that's across, like, tall shrub slash tree is the Heptacodium or the seventh sunflower. And to me, that one, it hasn't even started setting its buds yet. So it's a late summer bloomer, and it's absolutely fantastic. It's white cream in flower, and the fruit is kind of a maroon color, and it's absolutely fantastic. So can't beat it. And, yeah.
Well, I got to tell you what, Bill.
Is that enough to get you going?
For the moment, Bill in Wisconsin Dells has a question that relates to some of the things you've been talking about. Bill in Wisconsin Dells, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Love the show.
Thank you.
Could you give a little lecture or discussion about what the definition of full sun, partial shade, full shade, how many hours of daylight? I think that'd be a good point for a lot of the gardeners.
Okay.
Sure, no problem. Generally, when you're talking about full sun, you're looking at least 6 to 8 hours per day. And you're talking unobstructed sun. And there are plants that really will only do well in that full sun. So when you're talking full sun, it's really no shade. It's getting sun when the sun is out. Partial shade, and you know, this is going to be subjective because this is how I look at it, and I know that there are tables out there that will tell you this, but when you're looking at a plant that likes full sun to partial shade, we're not talking about a plant that's going to like to be in full bright sun and then in the afternoon go into deep shade. That's too much of a change. But if you're talking about something that's got a little bit of dappled shade and it gets sun during the day, either in the morning or in the afternoon, and shade at the other time, that can be partial shade. Or partial shade, you know, depending on what the plant likes and tolerates, could be a very light dappled shade all day long. Now, full shade is going to be something that the sun doesn't touch it, but you can have full shade with bright side light. And so if you're looking at maybe like an overhang where the light just barely misses where you have that plant, but there's plenty of ambient light, that to me is a lighter full shade. But if you're talking a deep, dark shade, that's really no sun hits it. That's like under a very, very deep maple shade where no sun is going to hit it at all. And you've got not a lot of ambient light that's shining around to it. Does that help out?
Oh, yeah. That's a good thing that, I have a lot of garden. I'm a gardener in Wisconsin Dells, and people walk by and we talk about plants and plant selection, and yeah, that's the big thing. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Liz Freemuth, our guest today. She provides concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hole. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at how you can provide the summer interest in your garden with Liz Freemuth, our guest today. She is the owner of The Garden Hole. She provides concierge horticultural services through her business. Larry Mueller here. Join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Carl in Black River Falls has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How do you get rid of this, like, moss that grows underneath catalpa leaves if they don't get raked, or under any foliage that doesn't get raked? And it's like a piece of cake almost. They're in a layer about a half inch, three quarter inch is thick, and it's a moss or something that you really don't want, I don't think.
Well, you know, really, people do try to grow that and have moss gardens. So I think it depends on whether you like it or if you don't like it. And where moss grows is in conditions that where it grows naturally, in conditions that it loves, which, as you just said, shade. And it will get actually quite deep, and it will love it, but it is a little bit on the touchy side. So, yeah, if you rake it up, that little bit of moss will be gone, but if conditions are going to stay the same, you can be guaranteed that it'll come back. Getting rid of it, you know, if it annoys you tremendously, then raking it up is really about the best thing to do. Now, moss likes to grow in moist, dark conditions, and often in areas where the soil is somewhat compacted. And, you know, when we see it in lawns and things like that, if we can moderate what's planted in there, like a shade grass, if you get that up and aerate slightly, even if it's around roots, even with a fork or something like that, often that's enough to allow the shade grass to take hold, and it will outcompete the moss. But otherwise, you're really kind of stuck with raking it up and just continuing to do that.
So there you go, Carl. Thanks a lot for calling. Jody in Baraboo. Your turn. Hi, Jody.
Hello. I just bought a house that has a lot of black walnut trees in the yard. And the previous owner did a great job with daylilies and hostas and things like that. But I'm wondering if there are other perennials that I can plant that are going to add a little bit of color maybe, or at least provide some interest in all that deep shade and the yucky stuff from the black walnut roots.
Yeah, there are a number of lists out there that that are, in my opinion, still trial and error depending on what your site is like, but definitely there are plants that will grow around black walnuts. I know raspberries, if you're looking for ornamentals, that can actually be a little bit tougher. I will tell you from experience that no, roses don't like them. And peonies, no, they don't particularly care for them either. But lilacs don't seem to mind them as much. Some of the tougher species will actually do better around those than some of the hybrids. But they don't seem to mind them tremendously much. And I know I do have a list. I don't have it at the top of my head, but I know I do have a list that I can send to Larry, or we can, you know, you can email me, and I'd be happy to send it out to you. That's A-okay. And actually, my email, I'll give it out in case anybody wants to ask me or, you know, get a list, is thegardenhoeknows@gmail.com. And it's just like it sounds, thegardenhoeknows@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to send the list out to you. But yeah, there are some, but it is going to be trial and error. Every site is not the same, and it really depends on how much juglone is in the soil as to whether some will or won't survive. Are you talking about deep walnut? Are there a lot of walnuts here?
Nine of them. Nine of them in my backyard.
Nine of them. Well, I think the list that I have put together is from about six or seven different states that have had success with various plants. But there are a number. I think we can find you some that will do okay for you, most definitely.
Yeah.
Email me and I'll send the list out to you.
Yeah, and if you want to send me that list too, Liz, we'll post it up on our page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'll put it under program notes for sure. So
I'm not around my computer, or else I would just send that out right now. So it'll have to be after 12:30.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. The number to call 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. If you phone, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Laura emailed that she has a dahlia that she overwintered in the basement with very little light and only occasionally watered. It came back. She put it outside and it's ready to bloom, so good for her. Also, she has a rose of Sharon bush that is almost entirely dead except for some front branches that have green leaves that look like they're growing from the main bush. She wonders how much should she prune off that Rose of Sharon.
Yeah, with the Rose of Sharon, which is Hibiscus syriacus, so it's a hardy, a northern hardy hibiscus. We do get dieback in tough years, and actually this year my dieback on mine was worse than it was last year, and I think it was residual from the horrible weather that we had in the late winter last year. And sometimes there's enough oomph left in that hardwood shrub to see it through the year, but not enough to make it through to the next year. So the nice thing about those is if you're seeing growth coming, then it does have some life in the main system. And Rose of Sharon does flower on old and new wood. So you can cut as much as you need to on that. I wouldn't go back too far into the main stem if it's a single stem. I wouldn't go too far in that. You know, go to where it's branching and cut off the dead stuff. But you can kind of work your way down to see if perhaps there is some live tissue in those. So, you know, we're going to do about a third of the way down the branch, see if anything looks live. Then do, you know, go another few inches and see if you've got live tissue in there. And then stop above a node of some sort and give it a chance to maybe leaf out a little bit later. And if it hasn't leafed out within about 2 to 3 weeks, then pretty much I don't think it's going to this year. And so then you can cut it back a little bit further. But again, it does flower off of old and new wood. And so you're really lucky that it's not going to take out all the blooms. They are susceptible to verticillium wilt also. And that will tend to take out part of the shrub or one branch at a time and then slowly kill it back. But again, I'm hopeful because she had new growth on that, that just cut off the dead stuff and allow it to go. And you can be pretty brutal. Again, they flower on old and new wood, so you can be brutal.
Dave in Broadhead has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Larry. We've been trying to grow the orange butterfly weed, and we've got two different plants. One of them is in a little garden in the back. It's full sun. There's no shade around it at all. The other one is in our perennial bed, and it's kind of growing between a peony and a Russian sage, and it's a little bit shadier. But neither one of them seem to be growing very well, and I'm just wondering, are they really that hard to grow, or do we need to do something to the soil, or what?
Well, how old is this plant? Let me ask you that.
Both of them are 3 years old, I believe.
Okay, and is it something that you've grown from seed, or did you get the plant and put it in?
No, we got the plant and put them in.
Okay, and species butterfly, so it's the orange species Asclepias.
Yes.
Okay. They can be a little bit touchy to get going once they take, though. I have had spots where it's taken 4 to 5 years for them to really be comfortable and establish themselves and be happy enough to flower. In other places, a year in, they look like they've been there forever. They do tend to like soil. In my experience, they do tend to like soil that's a little bit richer and nicer, but not particularly moist after they get going. That's where I've had the best luck with them. Now, where you see them growing out in nature, I would suspect that they wouldn't like that dryness, but in my experience, they have. But full sun, definitely. And you're seeing probably a bit of a reduction in the one because of the shade around it. But I would think that they will adapt okay, just maybe a bit more patience with those. And if you haven't fertilized, you might want to do a little bit of fertilization if the soil has not been amended. Has it
there
over the years?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. I appreciate it. Thanks. That helps.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Good luck.
Nancy in Verona, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just commenting on the woman that called in about the plants she's trying to grow around her walnut trees.
Yeah.
I have an extremely good luck with purple coneflowers.
Oh,
and
do you really?
They seem to just flourish. So it's something to try. And again, it's trial and error, like you said. Some hostas have, and yet the coneflowers love it. So,
Now have you tried any of the coneflowers other than the purple around the walnut?
I have not.
Okay, it's good to know that the purple coneflowers do well, though. That's an excellent one to try.
Yeah, and they're beautiful, and they will.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, so, Nancy.
Excellent.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you guys for all the calls, always.
All right. Well, speaking of calls, let's go to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hey, my kids think I'm crazy, but I've got an aloe vera plant named Harry, and I've been putting them outside in the sun. But my problem is, you know how the aloe vera plant is like kind of a flat thing? Well, the legs start to curl, and they're kind of dying off. Is that too much sun, or what do I do with that?
You may have given it too much sun right off the bat. Did you move it out slowly or just pop it outside?
I just popped Harry right outside on the driveway.
Harry might be experiencing some major burn there. Oftentimes when you're moving stuff from inside to outside, if it's done quickly, the cells in the plant don't have time to acclimate to that change in light, which can be quite dramatic for them. And I'm not sure with an aloe if it might be that it's going to take the top off and it'll be okay at the base. I'm not sure on that one because that one I haven't played with as far as burning it. So you may want to get Harry into a little bit more of a protected site and then see if you can gradually move it out again and into a brighter light. But then you would also do the same thing when you would move Harry back in for winter. that do it slowly. Okay. So you change it for a couple of days, you know, add a little bit more shade for a couple of days, then a little bit more, and, you know, move it back and forth to get those cells to adjust. Otherwise, okay. It's too much of a change. Yeah. And that's why, you know, like with the houseplants that lose their leaves when you move them around, too much of an adjustment for them to make. So they drop their leaves and they grow new ones. With the aloe, I would hope that Harry's going to sprout a new arm, but I'm not sure on that one. So let us know what happens with Harry, though.
Yeah, for sure, Nick.
I'll keep Harry in the back of my mind.
Thanks for calling. You know, as Nick was talking, I was remembering, this is years and years ago, I started some tomato plants from seed. And I was so eager to get them outside. And I just shoved them outside. And the next morning I go out and the plants are completely white.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It's amazing what they will do when we're not paying attention, right?
They lost all their chlorophyll.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Trish in Bailey's Harbor. Hi, Trish.
Hi. I have a question. I've been pruning lilac trees, and I pruned some suckers off of the tree, and I would like to grow that. Is it possible to transplant that and grow those suckers?
It can be. Now, which type of a lilac are you talking about? Are you talking about a single stem or a multi-stem lilac?
I guess it's more of a single stem, and it's a different variety. It's a pale pink, so it's not one of the mills.
Okay, but it's not the tree or the tree lilac, you know, with the white blooms on it. Not like that. The Peking violet. It's not one of those. So if it's
I don't believe
so.
No.
Okay. Yeah. You can, but it's my understanding that actually getting the suckers to root, it can be kind of difficult. Now, did you cut it off or dig it out of the ground?
I cut it off.
Yeah, I think when you cut it off, that means you're going to have to root it. And rooting cuttings on lilac can, I understand from propagators, can be a little bit more difficult. Now, if you can actually pull that root out of the ground from where, you know, even what you cut off, you might actually be able to get the roots out and get that into a nice loose mix, and that will grow. That will actually grow, because lilacs from the root will grow very easily. I'm well known for walking around the yard ripping them up out of the ground and just popping them back in. So they will do fine there, but I understand from propagators it's not the easiest thing to root. But I would give it a try. Why not?
Yeah. Why not? Get some rooting hormone in there for sure, I would think. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. That would be what I would do. And then you would want to keep it in a somewhat moist environment. And so really for the average person and what they've got around in the house, that would be keep it moist and, you know, maybe tent it loosely with plastic to keep the top of that rooting mix, keep that slightly moist, and then give it air periodically, and you can pull it out every once in a while and see if it's starting to sprout roots.
There you go, Trish. Thank you so much.
Give it a whirl and let us know if it works.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I will. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Trish. Yep. Mary in Chippewa Falls. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Larry. And I enjoy your show so much.
Thank you.
So you're welcome. So I have a question in regards to mulch. I've used the mulch, the wood mulch, and I always get it from, you know, a reputable place. And then last year, we go to Virginia originally from that area, and I noticed people use pine straw. So mm-hmm. I was able to get pine straw from a lady, and it was kind of nice, kind of recycling. And my plants that have not done anything for 5 years have just taken off. And I don't have any problem with the mushrooms and stuff like I do with the regular wood mulch. Do you have mm-hmm. any, I'm curious what's going on.
But which plants have done better with the pine as opposed to the wood?
I would have to say almost all of them. I have a stilbe, hydrangea, I'm going to say Rogelia, and believe it or not, this milkweed, I heard the gentleman before, the milkweed right now is about 3 to 4 feet high, and I didn't plant it.
Well, you know, for all of those that you mentioned, what they do like is to have their roots a little bit cooler, and they like it a little bit lighter weight on them. And wood mulch, if you think about it, has got larger, heavier, you know, kind of particles to it. But it also doesn't have the continuous cover that a contiguous cover as the pine needle does. You know, the pine needle straw really is almost like a blanket when you put it down. And so that can actually have a much more moderating effect on your roots, on your plant roots, than what the regular wood mulch might. And other than that, you know, there may be, depending on where it came from, there may have been some residual nutrients in there too that you were lucky enough to get with that pine straw. That would be fantastic. I know when I'm down south, that's used all the time. And I absolutely love the look of it. And it's very light. You can actually walk on it and it feels cushy. And so to me, that's probably just adding a nice, another little layer of protection and air and cover on that, which is just great for plants across the board.
And actually, if you think about it, if you put the wood chips or whatever on every year, as that starts to decay a little bit, it does tie up nitrogen in the soil, and that can have some effect.
Absolutely. And even wood that is somewhat decomposed, it still is going to draw nitrogen out of the soil, still is going to do that. And if you're not fertilizing on a regular basis, and ornamentals do need fertilization, and, you know, of course, get a soil test and see where you're at before you over fertilize. But ornamentals are heavy feeders, and vegetables are heavy feeders, you know, fruit are heavy feeders. So all of those things that we rely on for this 3-4 month period that we garden tremendously, they need to be fed. And so if that wood is pulling nitrogen up out and we're not putting anything back in, it is going to impact the plants. And when you do put wood mulch down, what oftentimes we forget to do is to really incorporate and fluff up those layers that have gone before. And, you know, if the wood mulch was taken off beforehand, that may have been beneficial. If it wasn't, this obviously, you know, if our plants are doing so much better, it obviously was a good thing to put the pine straw down on her planting. But, you know, you have to remember to really mix that up down there before you make it so thick and heavy and compacted that it's not doing any benefit for your plants or for you either. So,
and there you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Liz Freemuth, our guest today of The Garden Ho. Great to have her with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Liz Freemuth of The Garden Ho. Great to have her along. Her website is thegardenhole.com, so you can take a look and see what she's got on that website. If you have a question or a comment, give a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Catherine in Random Lake has a question for you, so let's go there. Catherine, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
I have some tree peonies, and they have put out some volunteers. Now, the volunteers don't look like either one of the parent plants, and they also bloom before the parent plant. They're done blooming, then my tree peonies bloom. And I was wondering if that's a, and it was, I just ran out real quick and checked. It doesn't have a woody stem.
Okay.
It's thicker than my other peonies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not woody like the tree peonies.
And it's not woody like, have you seen the Ito peonies, those that dry back? Because they have a little bit of a woody stem at the base.
I have a yellow one.
Okay.
And I didn't
Ooh.
Check that one just now, but it might be like that. It might be a thicker one, because I know that's thicker than my herbicula.
Yeah.
I can't say that word.
What can happen? I mean, did this baby, is it coming up away from the plant, or is it coming from the base of the plant and out, or does it look
separate?
I had
one plant that came up right between the two of my,
okay.
I have three tree peonies. It came up
okay.
right between two of the tree peonies. Then there's one that came up quite a bit of distance away that I figure was planted by the birds. And I've transplanted one, gave one to my daughter, and they're doing fine.
How long did it take them to flower for you once they started growing, the babies?
I didn't notice them until I started flowering because they flowered before.
So you weren't keeping tabs. You weren't keeping tabs
there. Yeah, but once they flowered before the earlier than my other peonies, then I saw the flowers and went, "What's this?"
What color are the three that you planted?
Okay,
what colors are they?
The white one is a distance away, so I won't count that. One is a dark
okay.
burgundy, and one is a darker pink. And this is a lighter pink, and it isn't as pom-pommy as the other two.
Okay.
It's a little
okay.
less.
Okay.
Yeah, and it has your tree peonies. Are they singles, partial doubles? Are they doubles? Because most of the time, tree peonies are going to be singles of some sort.
Well, I'd say they're the partial. They're not
partial.
Real puffy. They're not real.
Okay.
But they're not just a single petal around either.
Got it. Some of them will have two or three layers of petals on them, like
yeah.
that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But the baby that the errant one that showed up, that's a lighter pink.
It's a lighter pink, and it just
okay.
has a single around.
Yeah, and
like I said, there are three plants, and all three have the lighter pink like that. They're real similar.
Okay, now all three, as far as the ones that have popped up on them,
yes.
the babies that have popped up,
volunteers.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm guessing that these are, it has to be something in the parentage. And they're probably, you're getting crossbreeding from somewhere. And this is resulting in the babies that are showing up. Now, if it was right next to the tree peony, I would say it's sprouting from the root that was down there. But if it's a ways away, then more than likely that is from seed from one of the flowers that was cross-pollinated, dropped on the ground, and actually grew another plant, which happens frequently. It's just most of the time we either pull those things out thinking they're weeds as they're popping up, or they get mowed over if they're in a lawn or, you know, something like that. And it could be that if you have that same one coming up, that might be the dominant gene back in the parentage would be my guess. And if they're very similar in structure, color, petal number, the center, I mean, does the center of the flowers look similar across all of the volunteers?
The volunteers, yes. But what throws me off
okay.
is that it blooms earlier than the parent plant. That's what really throws me off.
Well, the parent plant that you have there, but the breeding that went in to get that parent may come from a completely different blooming period. You know,
yeah.
Because unless it's a species, then we know, you know, a kind of a heritage, it's a single, there isn't any other breeding in there, then you would expect to see the same child from the parent. But if you have a dark burgundy, there must be something that is going to give you that light pink in the background. So when the peony breeders were out there crossing things, they're going to cross this one with that one to get this. So it may have been a light pink that they liked for whatever, you know, whatever was in there, done with something else to get that burgundy. And my guess is it's coming from the parents of the parents. So it's going to be either the grandparents or the great grandparents that are giving you that strong gene that's coming through. And, you know, because they did pop up next to each one of different peonies, I wonder if it's actually not volunteers from each different one, but possibly the same seed that just got spread, you know, and that without actually knowing which cultivars they are and what the breeding background is, then it's going to be a little bit hard for me to guess. But that would be my, without seeing it, that would be my guess on it.
Pretty cool anyway, never, regardless you know, of how it got there.
It is, and that's actually how many of these things are found, where it's either intentional or accidental crossbreeding, or looking at what the children are doing as they escaped notice, and, you know, keeping those if they have characteristics that are desirable, or getting rid of them if they don't. And I find it extremely fascinating, and it might be worth sending some pictures to a peony breeder to see if it's of any interest to them, or even to know what the cultivar that she planted, what offspring it's sprouting, because that can be kind of fun and fascinating to them.
Yeah, that might, would be, yeah, maybe you can sell this, Catherine, become a millionaire.
There you go.
Or thousandaire.
Yeah, I was going to say in horticulture, it's not a millionaire. It's a hundredaire. That's really where it goes.
Oh, man. Thanks, Catherine. Mark in Toma, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, I've got a 30-year-old garden that's done really well for me over the years. I went down there last night, and five of my six tomato plants, the leaves are really starting to curl, and it almost looks like they're starting to die. And okay. I've never encountered this, so just curious if you had any ideas of what might be happening.
And well, Mark, does the plant look healthy right now, but just the leaves are curling?
Yeah, the plants, yeah. You know, I put yeah. them in at the end of May, and they were doing really, really well. One of the plants has fruit on it already, and these things typically get to be 4 or 5 feet tall. It's just been a very, very, you know, productive garden, and we've had like 5 inches of rain in the last 6 days, so I don't know if it's a water issue, but
I don't know about
what
that.
What kind of tomato is it?
So I got them from a local nursery here. I want to say they're like big boys.
Okay. And I, you know, off the top of my head, Larry, you probably have talked about this more in recent times than I have, but blight, you know, late blight, we're a little early for that. And so I don't suspect that yet. But they turning yellow and are they turning yellow and curling or just curling?
Right now they're just curling.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you close to any place that would have had chemical applications?
Gosh, I don't think so. I would say no. You know, what's okay, odd is the two that are on the north end of the garden are, you know, I'm out here now looking at them. They're 3 feet tall, blossoming. They're doing really, really good. The other four on the south end are, gosh, they almost look like they're about dead.
Okay, so same type, same tomato type?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so you've got all big boys, and is the south end lower than the north end?
No, it's all fairly level out here.
Yeah.
Okay, and what surrounds you?
Just residential yard.
Okay, residential yard can actually be a good place to look at what chemicals have been applied. Because the broadleaf weed control that gets done periodically when there's broadleaves out, when the temperatures get high, if it's been within about 2 weeks that that's been applied, they actually can revolatilize and float around and kind of hit stuff. So if if you're seeing atypical symptoms off of a planting that's the same across the board, then to me, I have to look at what's hitting that south end. And leaf curling, and if it's really curled, I mean, if it looks like you took your hand and that was the leaf and you curled those fingers in, if that's what the leaf is starting to do, and if that tissue between the veins looks tight and slightly shrunk, to me that says chemical damage. And sometimes they can rebound from that, and sometimes they won't. Now, a lot of rain will actually make them yellow, but I've not really been seeing any situation where excessive rain makes the leaves curl. Now, the other thing to look at would be to look at the underside of the leaf to see if you have insects running around on there. You know, because sometimes insects feeding can actually make those leaves curl in as well. And so I would take a look at that. And, you know, other than those two things, I can't think of anything. And what I would suggest, though, because it's really difficult to do over the phone, but what I would suggest would be to send pictures to Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and have him take a look at them to see if he's recognizing something in those symptoms that we would miss over the phone.
There you go. Liz Freemouth, our guest today, providing concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hoe. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And our guest today is Liz Freemouth. Back with us, she provides concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hoe. So what plant questions do you have? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Liz, just to go back to that tomato for a second, I was walking in the neighborhood almost a week ago, and walked by one of our gardeners working in her garden, and she recognized me and asked me what was wrong with her tomato plant, one of them, and a couple of the leaves were starting to curl, and I said, well, maybe it's a water issue. And then I went by a few days later, and there were a couple more leaves. And when I went by yesterday, there were a lot of leaves curling up and a particularly really healthy-looking plant. And I thought, somehow that plant's not getting – maybe it's not getting water. I didn't know that there's a borer that goes into the stem of a tomato plant that could cut off the water supply, but
boy, that I don't know either. And I know that right now with the weather and everything else we've got going on, I know Brian said that rusts are running rampant, and you know, again, without looking at it, it's hard to say what we're dealing with. And looking on the underside of the leaves can really help out an awful lot, because you may actually see rust on the underside of the leaves, or you may see insects, or you may see something else. But, you know, it never hurts to check the stem underground slightly, you know, like poke your finger around and take a look at what's going on in the stem just underneath the soil surface and see what all is happening. And right now, you know, we have been, I don't know about you guys, but down here in the southeastern part, they had called for rain for the entire week, and we virtually had little to nothing. And so many people shut off the irrigation or didn't water, thinking, you know, it was going to rain. And that does put the plants under stress to have plenty of water and no water, plenty of water, no water. So, so I would say really send a picture to Brian and have him take a look. He sees so many diseased things that he's got a beat hand down on what he looks at every day. That's for sure. While we were on break, and I could access some files on my phone, I took a look at Het Walnut at Juglone Tolerance. So I can say with some assurance that I can give her a few plants. You know, we can do that just now on what will grow underneath walnut plants. And we're looking at some of the things we had talked about early in the program. So Colquitzia is a shrub, does well. Hazelnut does well. Some dogwoods, I think it's more the silky dogwoods that do better. Also spicebush, the benzoin, Lindera benzoin, actually does pretty good. Mock orange, nine bark, rose of Sharon that we spoke about earlier. And then, you know, for smaller plants, there's bee balm and garden phlox. So that's the phlox paniculata, black-eyed Susans, astilbes, yarrows, a couple of different ferns will do, actually like four or five different ferns will do well. Hellebores do. Surprisingly, you know, it's always surprising to me that mums grow where you put them, and mums will actually tolerate juglone. So, you know, take a look at that. Jack in the Pulpit, lungwort, sedums, and then also lamb's ear, things in the Stachys family will do pretty well on around walnuts. So that should at least give her a start on what to look at, you know, before we get a complete list out to her.
Very good. Well, let's take a call. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Well, my wife and I aren't normally gardeners, but with being stuck at home, we decided to take that on, and we decided to create a straw bale garden. And I'm pretty sure we probably made every rookie error in the book. I'm wondering, I mean, like, we were conditioning with blood meal. It went through the different phases of the wheat sprouting, mushrooms, you know, everything else. But every plant we put into it has either just gone dormant or out and out died.
So
what we're doing wrong.
What kinds of plants did you put in it?
We tried tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, zucchini, you know,
cabbage.
We tried all kinds of things, just kind of a shotgun approach, and really nothing has survived.
Hmm.
Okay, Larry, straw bale is your bailiwick.
The fact that you got mushrooms and started growing, it sounds like you had the bales working well. Were they getting enough water?
It's been pretty wet, and okay. We are pretty diligent about keeping it watered.
Well, I am at a loss.
Well, what did the plants look like when they were declining?
They would initially start turning a darker shade of green, and then they would just kind of, they wouldn't grow. And then they would just wither up and die.
Okay, so they went dark green, and then they started to wither. Did you fertilize these at all?
We were conditioning with blood meal, put a lot of blood meal on it. I think we put then one dose of just a regular generic
fertilizer.
Yeah, okay. Any kind of lawn fertilizer with nitrogen is what I've used.
Yeah. And, you know, typically when you're fertilizing vegetable plants, you know, blood meal okay to start with, and then you really don't add much on vegetable plants in general. And straw bale, I will admit freely, know nothing about, other than I know you put them in straw bales because I grow in the soil. So I'm unfamiliar with.
Typically you would add a little bit of like a nitrogen fertilizer, like a lawn fertilizer, at least in the beginning, and then maybe another shot down the road a little bit just to keep them going. So
yeah, well, to me, fertilizing is really, really important with the vegetables. And early in the season, good. Then you wait until things start to bloom slightly. And then you start to fertilize again. And the reason being that if you fertilize too early, it can actually promote more vegetative growth than what's going into the flower and the fruit production. So you do it early to get the plant going and then allow it to kind of work and develop where the fruit is going to come from, and then start fertilizing so that it's going into the fruit production. But if things were really nice and green, I would suspect you had plenty of fertility. It's just then what happened to them after that. And did you notice any insects or anything like that on them?
No, not really. We do. I mean, I know that we have issues with Japanese beetles. We've got raspberry plants nearby, but we haven't seen anything like that on these plants.
Why don't you send me?
They just grow.
Why don't you send me a note? Send me an email to ideas@wpr.org, our site, Mike, and I'll look into it a little more and get back to you.
Well, I've got a question, and you know, and I ask this frequently, and people think I'm you know, anti-chemical that I ask, but lawn care products can actually take out vegetable plants pretty fast. And if you lost a cross species, and if they went out at about the same time, then I start to look at whether there was something environmental that took them out, as opposed to the plants not doing well. Because if you're talking peppers, tomatoes, cabbage, you know, and a host of other species in there, they're not all going to succumb to the same problem at the exact same time. So, you know, so if they actually started to react similarly at the same time, then I look at something outside impacting them. And right now we are at that prime time where we're seeing the results of broadleaf weed control that could be done, high temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. So those are questions that you have to take a look at in your yard. Did your neighbors use any? Did you use any? And, you know, oftentimes people do forget that Roundup does kill everything, and that's what it's made for. And so if you're using it on the driveway to kill weeds, if it can actually float around and get to the plants, it can take those out as well.
There you go. Well, and two, if you want to shoot me a note, Mike, I can look into it a little more and talk with some people who know even more. Well, almost anybody is in straw bales probably knows more than I know, but I'll be.
Well, you know more than I do about straw bales. not my thing, but you know what? Don't. Get
I think you're right, Liz.
Yeah, don't get discouraged, Mike. Though, because part of one of the beautiful parts of gardening is killing things, and so you're getting that right out of the way right off the bat. And I would say if you can find some more plants, get them into the bales again and give it another shot, especially if you've got the bales there and you've got the setup and it looked like they were doing well. It may have been something out of your control. So I would say don't give up. Go get some more plants. Give it another whirl. You can do it. You can do it.
Go for it, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
Sue and Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Before Lisa gave all the list just before the after the break, I did have a list here of stuff that we've grown under our black walnut trees for not quite a number of years that have been very successful.
Good.
And just a few. It's not as long as Lisa's, but there are things like you mentioned the ferns. One of that's hugely successful is the ostrich fern. We also have a lot of Lily of the Valley, Bleeding Heart, that's been there for a long, long time. Wood violets, and of course you mentioned Rebecca and Jack in the Pulpit, and of course the hostas and the daylilies. And one feature about the black walnut that I've kind of accidentally used to my advantage is the fact that it's a little later to leaf out than the other trees in the area. And so I have some tulip bulbs and daffodils that I've grown there for quite a number of years. They just come up year after year, and usually by the time they're past their bloom time and they're fading, the tree is fully leafed out. So it gets a healthy amount of sunlight in the spring to allow some bulbs to actually bloom.
Very good.
Let me ask you, on the Bleeding Heart, is there a particular one that does better for you? Do you have the white, the pink?
Well, it's the pink. It's the old-fashioned, and we've okay. lived here for 32 years, and it was here when we moved in, and this year it is like four times bigger than I've ever seen it, but it's
oh, fantastic.
It's
fantastic.
It just comes back year after year, and so whatever it is, it works.
There we
oh,
go.
Oh, fantastic. And,
thank you,
know,
Sue.
Some, oh, that's such a wonderful list to provide, and, you know, everybody's experiences are so valuable because we learn from everything. So it's great. You know, some of those that we kind of tend to think of as old-fashioned plants and we're not going to use, reinvestigate those. Like, you know, the bleeding hearts and the lilies of the valley, there's so much breeding work being done on those that you might think, well, I don't want pink, where there's beautiful white or there's small red or, you know, even like the lily of the valley where we just think it's, you know, little white lilies. So there's pink ones, and there's one that I especially love called Touch of Lemon that has a little tiny bit of light green bordering on yellow edge on the leaf. But then the flowers smell divinely, like almost like a lemon blossom. Or a lime blossom, you know, in case of limey. And so there's many, many variations that you can do on some of those kind of quote-unquote old-fashioned plants that will really beef up the yard.
Thank you, Sue. Let's go to Lynn in Wausau. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a blue muffin bush that's 10 years old that has never flowered, and I have a lilac bush, a Japanese lilac bush, that didn't flower at all this year. So I'm wondering what's going on.
Okay, let me ask you, as far as pruning on blue muffin, are you pruning it at all?
Yes, in the fall, and like right now there are a bunch of, like, you know, green shoots sticking up, and I'm tempted to chop them off because they look kind of ugly, but I'm wondering if I chop them off, if that's why it's not blooming.
Well, I'm guessing that anytime you have something like a blue muffin or, you know, a paniculata hydrangea or arborescence or something like that, that repeatedly doesn't bloom, but the plant does well, then to me that says you're impacting its bloom cycle somewhere. And if you are pruning a viburnum in the fall, and it's either a late spring or summer flowering plant, then you're probably cutting off buds that have already been set. And that may be why, with the blue muffin, that you're not getting the bloom. So I would say, go ahead and cut it off right now and then let it go until next summer. You know, if you can, if it's in a spot where you can stand it being slightly untidy looking, then you may want to just let it go for a full year to see if you're developing blooms on there. And if it looks healthy otherwise, you should be fine to cut it back almost as hard as you want and have it rebound. So if it's something that you need to monitor the height on, you could probably take it down to, what is it, like maybe about 3-4 feet high, 5 feet?
Yeah, about something. That.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could probably take it down to about 2 feet off the ground and let it just regrow, and that might stay low enough for you where you're not going to get antsy to go and cut it off before it flowers next year. Well, you know, I know we all have things that we like to do in our yard, and we like it to look a certain way. So I think in this case, you may have to cut it down lower to let it do what it needs to do for a year, and then see. And then you said your Japanese lilac that didn't bloom this year for you. When did you cut that? Because it may be the same thing.
Well, no, that one I trimmed early in July last year. And
no, that should, should be fine. Yeah, that should be fine then. Because that they're flowering right now and they're finishing up right now. So generally, if you hit that one before August, you're pretty good. But I would say, again, maybe don't prune that one if you can tolerate it. Don't prune it, either that or do it this week, and then just let it go for a year.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Lynn.
You bet.
Barbara in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. One is about a hydrangea that I planted It was supposed to be able to tolerate some shade, and I thought it was in the perfect place. But while the green growth is incredibly lush and it's a very healthy plant, it has never once bloomed.
And how many years?
Close to 10.
Oh, wow. Okay, pruning on that, are you doing any of pruning?
Yeah, I prune it. I have to prune it back, otherwise I wouldn't be able to get out my back gate.
Ah, and when are you pruning it?
In the spring.
Okay, and what type of hydrangea is it?
Oh, gosh.
Okay, let me ask you about the leaves and the structure then. Is it an upright hydrangea with woody stems at the base, or is it one that was this supposed to have big ball flowers, or
yes,
were they
more? They were supposed to be colorful, like pink or blue, but there's nothing.
Okay, so if it was supposed to be pink or blue, depending on which cultivar you have, you either can prune those or can't prune those at certain times. And so it may be that you're cutting the buds off of that as well. One of the biggest things is to figure out which kind you have. And what you can do, because I know a lot of the Master Gardener organizations will help with plant ID. And coming in contact with people, usually it would be take a sample into the extension office, et cetera. But right now everybody is doing everything by photo. So if you could take some photos and send them to your extension office, and if you get pictures of the plant in its entirety, so you can see the habit of how it's growing, and then of the leaf structure and the stems, they can help you pinpoint what type of hydrangea you have, and then you can get on a pruning schedule that's going to allow those buds to develop and then flower for you. One of the provisos with anything that's pink and blue is that really is more of a southern plant, and we do have difficulties getting anything pink or blue to be pink or blue and bloom around here. So you may have to add to the soil, and you may have to take a little bit of care. But if it's large and lush in its vegetative growth, I think it's just moderating your pruning schedule, and you'll probably get some flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There you go.
My other question is about a Norfolk Island pine, which I've had for close to 30 years. It was in my office before I retired. Then I brought it home, and little by little, over the last few years, it's been getting pitifully bare.
Okay. So we've got only about 30 seconds for an answer there, Liz.
Okay. Check the roots. That one, it could be way outsized for its pot. And if the roots look healthy, then I'd say repot it and give it a whirl and get it fertilized, and maybe you'll get a rejuvenation on that.
There you go. Thank you so much, Barb, for calling. And Liz, thank you so much. Always a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, thanks so much.
Liz Freemuth provides concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hoe, and her website, thegardenhoe.com. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll talk about, climbing roses. So we'll look forward to that as well. And on Monday, we'll hear from the weather guys, and we'll talk about air quality in Wisconsin. In the meantime, have a great weekend, but please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.